This is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents Troubled Waters in a Globalizing World, Community, Property, and Conflict Over a Vital Resource by Amita Bhaviskar, University of Delhi, India, on Thursday, November 4th at 7:30 p.m. at the U of I's Levis Faculty Center. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the English Concert with violinist Andrew Manzi for a concert of Baroque music, and the St. Petersburg Philharmonic with conductor Yuri Timurkanov and pianist Ivo Pugarelic. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we welcome to the program, welcome back, I suppose I should say, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School. And once a month, always on Monday, 10 o'clock hour, generally, I shouldn't say always, but pretty much almost always, she is here to talk about women's health. She comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new, perhaps things that are in the news. And if you have questions on that, you certainly can call. But we're open to whatever might be on your mind, as long as it falls in her area of practice. We've talked about a lot of different things over the years with her. So you should take it as an opportunity to call in and ask questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, what would you like to talk about here?
Well, we have all kinds of new things. The newest estrogen to be released is an actual formal product that's a transdermal application. It's like a lotion, essentially. Okay. So I thought maybe people would be interested in that. In the Journal of the American Medical Association, there was an article about vitamin D deficiency, and actually people who live in the northern part of America, which definitely Illinois falls in that category, are much higher risk for vitamin D deficiency than other individuals. We are starting to move into an era also where we're going to be changing some of the package insert guidelines for birth control pills, and they are changing some of the recommendations for various types of contraceptive methods and removing some restrictions that we used to have. And I thought I would talk about a few of those new things. And part of those guidelines even affect women that are HIV positive, and there's been some news reports about HIV positivity rates, and if we run out of things to talk about, we have a lot of new research studies that I'm involved with, things for women without periods, things for women with heavy periods. We're still working on HPV prevention vaccines and menopausal kinds of conditions, including osteopenia and osteoporosis, so I actually have quite a bit to talk about.
Okay.
I see, well, we have a caller. I didn't know if you wanted to do that first.
Let's do that rather than make them wait. We'll get to the caller, and I'm sure we'll have time to talk about some of these other things too.
Sounds good.
The first caller is in Whiteheath, and this would be line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. Now, in the paper on the 21st was an article about birth control pills and how they help cut heart risk. And now, I have two questions. One is, what are the differences between the birth control pill and the hormone replacement therapy, the various components to them? And then if they are similar, then why does the hormone replacement therapy pill, if it's similar, and I don't know if it's similar, I think it's similar, why is it that they get such a bad rap, but the birth control pill gets a big boost from this study?
Well, I've been at meetings for a couple of days, and I must have missed that particular article. I did notice about 10 days ago, I thought, in the Wall Street Journal that they had redone an analysis of the Women's Health Initiative information regarding heart disease and hormone therapy, specifically looking at younger women and specifically seeing a trend towards protection, not causation. And let me back up a little bit. Birth control pills are usually a nickname for combined oral contraceptive steroids. And they usually have some estrogen and some progesterone, except for the POPs, or some people used to call them the mini pills, the progesterone-only pills that just have progesterone. In menopausal hormone replacement therapy, most of what we treat in terms of menopausal symptomatology, we use estrogen only for. And when you are in menopause, if you still have a uterus, giving estrogen only, since you aren't now naturally making any of your own progesterone, that if you only use estrogen, there's a stimulation effect on that lining tissue of the uterus, so that if you do have a uterus, we add progesterone into hormone replacement therapy. And if you don't have a uterus, we use estrogen alone. The doses that are needed to treat menopausal symptoms with the estrogens that can be quite similar. There are more types of estrogens available for hormone replacement therapy than for birth control pills. There's only one kind of estrogen in all the birth control pills in the United States. And the dose that you need to control a menopausal symptom is actually much less than the dose that we use in birth control pills. In birth control pills, the contraceptive effectiveness of birth control pills is because of the fairly strong dosing of progesterone. And it's progesterone that shuts down ovulation and provides a change in the cervical mucus. And it's what allows those pills to be protective against getting pregnant. And we use the estrogen in those pills to balance the effects on the lining tissue so women don't have irregular bleeding and some other things like that. So you're absolutely correct. They're very similar, except that birth control pills are actually much stronger. There's also another fundamental difference between birth control pill use and hormone replacement use, in that women on birth control pills are much younger. And young women don't have a very big risk of heart disease. But if you look at certain individual groups of women, let's say women over the age of 35 who smoke and take the birth control pill, you would see a dramatic increase in her risk of heart disease if she actually took the birth control pill. So that there is some information regarding potential risks in certain categories of people. We've also started to learn about women who have inherited an increased tendency to clot, and those individuals might have increased risk of not only throwing an embolism, but a clot. And we know that in laboratory and animal evidence, there's a lot of reason to think that the reason women have fewer heart attacks when they're young than men and more when they're older has to do with our own natural body estrogen. So that there is laboratory evidence that if we could keep that natural balance, that in fact we could prevent heart disease, not cause it. And taking hormone replacement therapy in the early menopause, when you're in your 40s and just transitioning in your early 50s, may in fact still be protective against heart disease. But we've changed the recommendation saying don't use that therapy thinking that it's going to be protective against heart disease. Only use that therapy if you need that therapy for other reasons. And we certainly haven't heard the end of the heart story. And without spending hours and hours of lecturing about heart disease, I want to emphasize it's a very complicated topic, and we certainly have talked about many aspects over the years on this show, but in fact, your lipids, your blood clotting factors, your weight, your blood pressure, how you respond to stresses, your overall stress hormones in your body, these are all factors that interplay with these compounds and are responsible for the confusion in the current literature.
Well, it's so confusing because this is in a local paper, and it says the same huge federal study that led millions of women to abandon use of hormones after menopause now provides reassurance that another hormone concoction, the birth control pill, is safe. So it just,
But that's a sentence out of context, so I apologize.
Well, fax I don't me know.
My fax number is 356-5849. No. I will read it. There's so much in the paper it's tough.
This was just the most recent thing, though, and I thought, it's very confusing, and you think, okay, now I better do this because I'm going to do that, or if I don't, and then you hear something else, and then it's just like... what do we do? We don't do anything, or we do something. I don't know. It's just so.
Well, as I've said before, you sit down with your own physician, and you want to minimize your risk of heart disease. And what you and your own physician need to do is say, how do I minimize my risk of heart disease? And you come up with a strategy. And then anything else that you add into the picture, am I going to go on a birth control pill? Am I not? Am I going to go on hormone therapy? Not. You want to find out if that is going to adversely affect your overall risk or, in fact, help your overall risk. And that's the context you want. You can't separate it out into this one sentence, one pill.
No, I know that. But it's just like they keep coming up with different information all the time. And so it just gets to be...
It is different, but if you really scrutinize what they're saying, very often it only applies in certain situations, so that it's additional, not necessary. Some of it is different, but a lot of it is just additional and applies to certain risk groups.
Yeah, well, there were 162,000 people that they studied, so it's not a small study. Whatever. Okay, well, I just thought I would throw that out there as a starter.
Thanks.
This morning.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. And I'm looking at an article here. This is on WebMD, and I think that it's the study that the caller was referring to. This was a study that was based on data from the Women's Health Initiative study.
Okay, that's what was quoted in the Wall Street Journal.
And
so
it
really doesn't talk about birth control pills.
The headline is Birth Control Pills May Lower Women's Risk of Certain Cancers and Heart Disease. It was a study done by some people at Wayne State. It was presented at the annual meeting of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, and it used data from the Women's Health Initiative.
Okay, so what they're doing in that group is they're doing some sort of... intake history, because that the Women's Health Initiative studied menopausal patients. So obviously, in their intake history, they were looking specifically at people that had in previous times been on birth control pills, and they're probably saying that use in the past didn't increase their overall risk of heart disease. Mm-hmm. Is what I remember from that study. I didn't know that. Okay, that's the Women's Health Initiative data, but see. Specifically, that would be using hormone therapy primarily as a woman enters menopause. And then the big Women's Health Initiative study was the average age of women was 63, and it was probably a study of secondary prevention. So it really isn't contradictory data. They're really talking about two groups of patients.
Yeah, okay.
It's a secondary analysis. And you have to be a little bit careful interpreting the secondary endpoints on studies, because the studies aren't always powered to answer those secondary questions. They look at them, but they're not powered to be enough statistically significant. And if it's the information that I think she's now referring to, is it was not powered enough to really be statistically significant, but it was more in the trends along what we'd been saying to begin with.
Okay. I guess that as I look at it, maybe the question they were interested in was what does use of the birth control pill earlier in a woman's life, what does that have to
does that increase
in the long
run?
Right.
And we've known, they've had done other analysis like that, and we know that hasn't been an increased risk factor.
All right. Let us go to someone calling from Southern LaSalle County. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I would like to have a laywoman's view of non-diabetic peripheral neuropathy, if I'm saying it all right.
Okay, I'm not sure I understand the question. You want to know what it is?
Yes, just generally.
Because
there wasn't much on the computer about it.
Yeah, peripheral means on the outside. So peripheral tends to refer to our hands and feet.
To
what? To our hands and feet.
I see.
Rather than the nerves in the central part of our body.
I see.
And neuropathy is a condition where the nerves themselves are affected so that they do not function as well, so that there could be numbness or tingling or pains, and those are all symptoms controlled by our nerves. And it is true that diabetics have effects on the nerves that can cause these symptoms, and in particularly the feet. But there are other conditions, and not being as current on my neurology as a gynecologist, I can't just off the top of my head list too many for you. But in general, that's what it's referring to.
Could you tell me when is the onset of that? Can you be younger or older or what?
Well, the average patient is older, but there are conditions that can affect young individuals.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go back here to someone local. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wonder, Suzanne, if you would be willing to address the issue of the increase of HIV in older women, and also whether as a gynecologist you test women, or at least offer an HIV test to women somewhat routinely. And I will hang on and listen.
Okay.
Well, we have seen an increase in HIV in older individuals. Anyone who is sexually active in a non-monogamous, non-mutually monogamous relationship is at risk for HIV. And we know that statistically younger individuals are more sexually active, and the more sexually active you are and the more partners you have, the increased incidence of HIV. Off the top of my head, I don't know as many statistics with HIV as I do with human papillomavirus, but just for an example, but the patterns of transmission are, in terms of any sexually transmitted disease, are somewhat similar in that, for instance, with the human papillomavirus infection across all age groups, if you've had one partner, you have about a 1 in 10 chance of testing positive for that virus. But if you've had 10 partners or more in your life, you have over a 60% chance of testing positive. So that when we as gynecologists and obstetricians take care of patients, we usually work on a at-risk kind of policy, meaning that anybody who's pregnant will routinely get tested for HIV as part of their prenatal care, as it's fairly standard. They'll have that offered. They certainly could decline. In gynecology, we do more risk assessments in terms of younger individuals and individuals that have more partners, and then with those kinds of things offer more testing, and that's pretty much across the board how it works. I know there have been studies looking at patients that literally just walk in the front door at hospitals, and because we don't test every single person that walks in the front door, say an emergency room or an urgent care center, we miss actually thousands of cases that could be diagnosed. And we know that it's very important to test both younger individuals and older individuals. We know that there are some studies that have specifically looked at what are things that cause transmission rates. And for instance, although spermicides in the right combination can actually be viricidal, kill off viruses, including the HIV, too much spermicide use, like when they've done these studies in sex workers and so forth, can irritate the lining of the vagina so much that it actually increases your chance of acquiring HIV. Whereas in menopause, one of the factors is that menopausal patients, particularly those not on estrogen, will have increased vaginitis from atrophy, from a thinning, a natural age-related thinning of those tissues. And that has actually been shown to increase HIV transmission. So we are seeing more of it in the United States. We don't have near the problem. I think there was just a study released in the Journal of the American Medical Association showing that in South Africa, there's something like incredible percentages. By age 22, at least 25% of the women, 1 in 4 women by age 22, were testing positive for HIV in South Africa. Now, you know, we don't see anything like that, but again, it's still statistically more likely associated with the youth.
Could I ask another question?
Sure.
Concerning youth and childbearing age. What's the outlook now for an HIV-infected woman bearing an uninfected child?
Well, it depends on what's going on with the case. If you are someone who is HIV positive and you're under treatment and you specifically get pregnant and stay under treatment, the chance of that child being born uninfected is very high. The success rates are very good at transmission protection if you're able to take medicines and stay on those medicines through most of pregnancy and the birthing process. If you are somebody who comes in with no prenatal care and this HIV condition is not recognized until well into labor, we have rapid tests now that we can offer patients so that we can find out when you're in labor if you're positive, even if you haven't been tested before. Then the transmission rates are significantly higher. Not 100% by any means, but they are higher.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you for the call. Let us continue. We have somebody else here ready to go, and this caller is also in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I have been on the transdermal estrogen for about a month and a half, and I find that I am a lot better on it. But I think the main reason that I'm better on it is because it has no lactose. And I'm wondering what the thinking was behind its development. I think people who are as sensitive to lactose as I am are pretty rare.
Well, with the transdermal products, there's more than one way to get a transdermal application. Traditionally, or relatively traditionally, we've had the patch delivery system, and now we have these cream delivery systems. And actually, compounding pharmacies have been able to make these kinds of creams, or you can put them in other things, oils, and that sort of thing. I think the main impetus to transdermal application has been twofold. One is to try to achieve a method that would have the most stable blood levels possible. And it is true that you can get more stable levels with transdermal applications than you can with swallowing pills, particularly because individuals tend to forget. Like, they've done birth control pill studies where they show that even the most consistent people, the average is to miss about 8 pills a year. It's not a big deal, but that is a few pills. Also, the secondary goal at transdermal application is to avoid what physicians call avoid the first pass hepatic effect. And essentially, when we swallow a pill, the bloodstream will pick that hormone up out of the stomach and the upper intestine and send it straight over to the liver, where it will have maximum liver effects. Now, some of those liver effects might be beneficial. For instance, we see better of the good type of cholesterol because of that potent liver effect. But there are other liver effects that may not be so beneficial, and one of them may be a slight increase in clotting factors. So that if you apply the hormone either through an injection or a patch or a cream, you avoid that system where it goes straight to the liver, so that by the time the hormone gets to the liver, there's still some effect, does get to the liver, but in fact it will have been somewhat metabolized by the bloodstream, so it's not as potent, so that the effects on the liver are not as potent. Now, clinically, we have not really been able to show that for large segments of the population that this is going to make a big difference, but in theory, it could be a potentially safer method.
I am on the cream, and because I'm also allergic to all the adhesives and all the patches. Thanks a lot for your
okay. Right. And the thing with the cream is different from the patches. I might want to add, and I don't know if this was important in your case, but. And digestion problems are an issue, not just the lactose, but there's other digestion problems as well. But the cream goes into the fatty layer of the dermis, the skin, and it acts like a little reservoir, and then it releases the hormone over time, whereas the patch it itself is the reservoir. So it's a little bit different, but it still acts quite similar in that it has these very steady blood levels that help women relieve their hot flashes. And the newer cream that was just released, the Estrazorb, does only come in one dose. So adjusting the dose with the one that's available is not yet possible, but this may be something in the future that will be possible.
I find that the worst thing about it is it's just a pain to put on. And I think I'm missing more doses just because I don't want to bother with a mess. But when I do use it, I feel a lot better than when I have used any other type of estrogen replacement therapy.
There's also a vaginal ring that you can actually wear for months, and it will release small amounts of estrogen. So that's there are other possibilities.
Yeah, I'll look into that. Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. And does that have whole body effects? Does that the estrogen circulate through the top?
There are two different rings. There's available two different brands of rings, and there's one brand that doesn't leak enough to have a whole body effect, and there's a different brand that does.
So it depends on what it is you're wanting to achieve by
right, like doing the it. Okay. The new contraceptive vaginal ring that you wear for actually 3 weeks, and it provides a very similar hormone level to quote-unquote oral contraceptive pills. So that when we talk about birth control pills, we're really talking about the whole class of patches and rings and pills. Injectables, somewhat in that category, at least a lot of the general contraceptive recommendations apply to all those different things, even though a lot of people just call them birth control.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School once a month. On a Monday, she's here. We talk about women's health. If you have questions, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. We do also have the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Well, one of the things you mentioned at the beginning of the show had to do with vitamin D and vitamin D deficiency. And this, I don't know if people understand that part. We do get some vitamin D through the food that we eat, and generally it's in milk. But also another way that you get it is from
the
sun.
Put it in milk.
That's right. I'm sorry.
A cow wouldn't put a lot of vitamin D into milk.
You're absolutely right. It's put into milk. It's fortified. They put it in there because they know we need it. And also we get it from the sun. Although now we're coming into the time of the year when
there are a couple of problems with getting our vitamin D from the sun. Number one, we live in a part of the hemisphere where the sun's never as direct. Secondly, we live in a part of the world where we get cold, so we put on clothes. Third of all, we've started using a lot of sunscreen and sunscreen-type clothes as well. And all those things repel the ability for the skin to generate vitamin D from natural sources. There's also a lot of vitamin D in certain types of oily things like sardines and things that we don't tend to have a lot of in our diet. So that you're right, that supplementation is pretty much the most important way that we do get our vitamin D. And a lot of patients that are in the menopausal time or older have started to be aware of the risk of osteoporosis and osteopenia that we've talked about, and they know that they need vitamin D supplementation, and so a lot of the over-the-counter calcium products actually are fortified with vitamin D as well. So those individuals have started to get more vitamin D that way, but it turns out that a new study that was released in the Journal of the American Medical Association did show that, in fact, vitamin D deficiencies are very, very common, and apparently this is nothing that most of us do test for clinically. When I run studies on osteopenia and osteoporosis, they sometimes do blood levels of vitamin D, and I think, oh, this is curious. One study I was starting specifically excludes people with vitamin D deficiency, and I thought, oh, well, that's silly. I never see that. As you probably know, that being deficient in vitamin D is called the disease rickets, and we think of rickets as being something you read about in novels of people crossing the ocean on ships or something. But In fact, apparently childhood rickets is still an issue. That might be something that you could talk to the pediatricians about. But mm-hmm. also adult rickets is apparently a lot more common. And vitamin D deficiency not only can predispose you to osteopenia and osteoporosis, but vitamin D deficiency has a lot of different symptoms like fatigue and general body aches. And actually, quite a few of my patients do complain of that, and it is something that I'm starting to do a little bit more testing of. They talk about, they did this study in Minneapolis where they saw individuals from age 10 of 65 years old who specifically had these aches and pains and fatigue, and they found that that about a quarter of these individuals were significantly vitamin D deficient, and at least 3% of them were deficient enough to have rickets. So that apparently there's even populations out there that don't even have these symptoms where it's still a problem. And it is a blood test that you can get. There are a lot of different metabolites of vitamin D circulating in our system. So they have their suggestion of which type of vitamin D to test for, and it's something that clinically for my patients I'm kind of looking into and seeing whether you need whole panels of this or and how much these tests cost and whether insurance is going to cover it. These are the – you see the article, but the practical reality – the article never tells you that sort of thing. But it's very interesting, and they have also found that it talks about the fact that vitamin D deficiency might be a factor in certain kinds of cancers and other types of diseases as well. So I think we're going to hear a lot more about it. I think we're going to see a lot more vitamin D testing.
Hmm. Well, if say you have someone who would say, well, I think that I have a reasonably healthy, balanced diet, and in addition, just to make sure, I'm taking sort of a standard multivitamin mineral supplement, just a one-a-day kind of a thing. Could someone like that still not be getting enough vitamin D?
Apparently. And a lot has to do with what really are the components of your diet and apparently how well you absorb what you're getting. Most of the reason we have to take so much of those calcium supplements is we pass so much through. And so some people may not be absorbing as well as they should. And apparently if there are people who have deficiencies. If you don't get tested, you can't for sure say that you're getting adequate levels.
Yeah. And it is, just again, to make sure people understand that vitamin D is one of the things, it's important for calcium absorption. That's one of the reasons why they put the D in the C
right.
and D in the calcium together.
Correct.
Right. Okay. We have other callers. So we have a couple of people here in Champaign. First line one right here. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking HRT, and we've been up and down on the dose a little bit, and now I'm noticing I'm getting varicose veins, and I'd like to know if you know hormonally what might be causing varicose veins.
Well, there are two types of varicose veins. There's external and internal, and the ones that you can look down at your legs and your ankles and see are usually called external varicosities. And as far as we know, they probably are not very closely related to any hormone therapy that you're taking. They tend to come on with age. They tend to come on in terms of your genetic background. So if your mom had them, you're more likely to have them, for instance. And also certain kinds of exercise that we do with pounding and that sort of thing can increase them as well. We also tend to get more as we get heavier. And so there are other causes rather than just starting a therapeutic dose of hormone therapy.
I had thought there must be some hormonal component because you get them when you're pregnant.
Well, you do tend to get deep veins a little bit more commonly when you're pregnant. And also you tend to get varicosities when you increase the blood flow in your blood vessels, and in pregnancies, your blood expands by 1.5 times, and you don't pump because of that big uterus. You don't pump your blood as efficiently back to the heart and around in the circulation, so you get more, you get a pressure effect on the vessel, so the blood backs up into the lower extremities, and so that is, there's that mechanical effect as much as anything, and we've never really been able to establish whether that is the complete cause or whether there's an additional hormonal component, because you can't do pregnancy without the hormones. So we don't really know whether the hormones cause additional blood vessels to form or change the actual nature, other than this pure accommodation of all the extra fluid and all the extra stasis in your legs of the fluid.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Well, let's go to another Champagne caller, and this caller's on line number two. Hello.
Hi. Can you tell me, for someone who already has osteopenia and may be taking medication for acid reflux, how does that affect absorption of vitamin D or calcium or both?
Well, I'm not sure I totally understand the question, but in general, acid reflux would not be a prohibiting factor in absorbing your calcium or your vitamin D. There are certain medications for osteopenia that can exaggerate the problems with acid reflux and can prohibit you from taking your medicines or being able to stay on those medicines, and that's kind of unrelated to vitamin D per se. Is that what you're asking?
Well, I have been told that in general, any medication that you take for acid reflux can affect absorption of many kinds of nutrients and vitamins. And I'm just wondering specifically if you know of any studies or anything that indicates that if you're on medication for acid reflux that you won't have as good absorption of calcium and vitamin D.
Well, a lot depends on when you take your calcium and your vitamin D and exactly what other medicines that you're on. So that depending on what you're taking, you would definitely want to consult your pharmacy about what's the right timing. And also, sometimes the calcium that you take can affect the absorption of the other medicine that you have to get in your system. Specifically, medicines for osteopenia, you want to space the time out before you take anything else, and that helps to combat that problem. But yes, competing absorptions are important with every medicine.
Okay. And are there any osteopenia medications that are less likely than others to aggravate acid reflux?
Well, definitely. The prevention of osteoporosis, when you're osteopenic, traditionally, the reason that you take medicine is to prevent osteoporosis, and the choices that you have are bisphosphonates, you have SERMs, which are selective estrogen receptor modulators, you have estrogens as well. We don't tend to use estrogens anymore as primary therapy unless you can't take the other medicines. The only SERM available for the treatment and prevention of osteoporosis is raloxifene, and it does not seem to cause any problem with acid reflux. I'm in the process of doing some studies on medications that are bisphosphonates that can be dosed a little bit differently and a little bit less frequently. And we're specifically looking at whether people tolerate that kind of medicine better than the other currently available bisphosphonates. So there's quite a bit coming.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. This, as long as we're on the subject of osteoporosis, and I'm not sure what more we can say about that, but it has within the last, I don't know, week or 10 days or 2 weeks has certainly been in the news because the Surgeon General put out a report. The first time the U.S. Surgeon General has ever put out a report dealing with bone health, trying to get people to understand that osteoporosis is a problem, and it's making these projections that we could see a lot more of it within the next, maybe 15 years. And what they're obviously doing is encouraging people to do the kind of things that you've been talking about here.
Well, it's definitely, we're living longer, and one of the primary factors in increasing risk is age. So that's going to increase the absolute numbers of population. People are having poor diets in their teen years. We were talking about medication, but pops have a lot of phosphorus, and that can bind your calcium. So if you swig your calcium pill at the same time you swig your diet pop with phosphorus, it's the bubbliness of pop that causes the problem. That definitely reduces your calcium. There's been a long time some studies suspected of being important, but they've gotten a little beaten up. There's some contradictory literature, but very high protein has been thought to cause calcium loss as well. And so people are asking, is this current popularity of the low-carb diet actually going to put you at risk for increased calcium loss? And we're not sure about that. There are some contradictory studies, but it is worrisome. And now we're finding out that people are more deficient in vitamin D. So there's all these reasons that people may have increased osteopenia as they get older and osteoporosis. Also inactivity. You need to be active to have strong, healthy bones. And as a population, we're not as active as we should be.
Well, besides these three things, making sure that you have adequate calcium, vitamin D, and that you have to have some, particularly some weight-bearing exercise that also helps it get incorporated into your bones. Besides those three things, is there anything else, or is that basically the...
Well, those are definitely the most important factors, but there's other factors. Steroid use, there's other medicines, thyroid medicines, certain antihypertensives, certain anticonvulsants. There are your alcohol consumption, your family history, whether or not you've had previous fractures. There are a whole list of possible risk factors that are of secondary importance that you could discuss with your physician. And then the bottom line is get tested. And it's such an easy, painless test and not very expensive and very well covered by many insurance plans. And getting tested and knowing where your bones are is very important.
We have someone else to talk with here. This caller is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have been taking Levothyroid for 28 years because I had my thyroid out because of cancer. I have osteopenia now. I know that the medicine for that thyroid condition is affecting it. Recently, they've dropped it from 0.125 to 0.1. Can I expect that to affect my bone loss? I have not wanted to take Fosamax or Actonel, but recently a friend has said that she had very good luck with the nasal spray. At the time that my doctor was giving me the information on all of my choices for meds, she said the studies didn't show conclusively that the nasal spray was effective. So I want to know about the two things. One, will the reduced dosage of Levothyroid slow down the bone loss? And how effective is the nasal spray?
There's been no study that shows a direct answer for you in terms of dose and thyroid medicine. In general, if it's biologically plausible that a medicine can affect it, then it generally makes good biological sense that a lower dose would affect it a little bit less. But there are so many factors that affect your overall bone health that one factor may not dramatically change things. A lot depends on your overall bone strength. And the only way we have of measuring your overall bone strength is to measure that thickness of bones, those bone studies. And that really, the thickness only represents about 75% of bone strength. So there's a 25% piece we don't really even get information on. Also, your overall bone turnover rate. And that can be measured by urinary markers. There are some blood tests. Again, not something that's used a lot clinically, but what your overall bone turnover rate is. In terms of the second part of your question, you said... I'm sorry, your first part was whether the...
It's about the nasal spray.
The nasal spray, sorry. Lost track of that in my head. The Miacalcin nasal spray is an extremely good treatment for women or men, individuals with who have an actual diagnosis of osteoporosis and have an actual diagnosis of bone pain. And they have shown that it is effective for pain treatment. It is also effective to prevent non-vertebral fractures. Most of the non-vertebral fractures that we worry about are, in fact, in the hip. And it is not a medicine that it's actually approved for use in osteopenics. So okay. That would be an off-label use by your physician, which that physicians are permitted to do that. But the studies were not powered enough with that medication. They also weren't particularly well enough done to treat the younger individuals or individuals with osteopenia. You have to study large groups of people for long periods of time to be able to actually show fracture prevention. And the FDA does want to look specifically at fracture prevention, not so much just as your number improve, because the numbers aren't everything when it comes to bone health. And so that in general, with my patients for osteopenia, I try to recommend that they stay with medications that are, in fact, approved for treatment of osteopenia, not necessarily osteoporosis. Now, if you're osteopenic and have extremely high risk factors, then that may be something different to consider. And like I say, with one of our bisphosphonates that we're testing, it can be administered intravenously, which completely bypasses the problem with the acid reflux and the irritation. And so we're involved with a research study specifically looking at individuals who can't take the oral bisphosphonates, who might want to consider less frequent dosing and using intravenous medicine, which doesn't have to be given very often during the year.
Okay, one other question. Someone has just mentioned to me taking strontium, I think, for bone health. And I read some research on it, one of which says they can't really tell the difference whether it's calcium adhering to your bone or the strontium itself. And I wondered if you had read anything about that.
Well, there are many micronutrients that are important for bone health, and we don't know the optimum amounts for all of them for every individual, and we haven't yet reached the time where we can do enough blood studies to help people figure out what doses of the micronutrients. So that generally those vitamin complexes that also have minerals or that are designed for older individuals do have some of those nutrients. It's not just strontium, but some of the other things that might in fact be important for bone health, because overall you even need K and you need E and you need lots of different vitamins for overall bone health.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. We're getting close to the end of the program here, but I'm sure that if someone has a question they want to call right away, we can get them in.
I'll sneak them in.
Otherwise,
I answer it quickly. I wanted to talk a little bit about contraception. The World Health Organization classifies types of contraceptives and their safety recommendations, so that their class 1 medications are use this method in any circumstance whatsoever, and class 4 is do not, under these set of conditions, do not use this type of medicine, and class 2 would be generally use the method, and class 3 is that the use of the method is not recommended unless other more appropriate methods are not available or acceptable. And when I give lectures on contraceptive safety and effectiveness to students, I usually talk about these World Health classifications, but I usually caution my students, and I'm cautioning the listeners, that most physicians can't quote the WHO 1, 2, 3, 4, and they've often either not heard of it or it's not something that they always use clinically. But the Association for Reproductive Health Professionals has good description on their website. I think it must be ARHP.org. And I know that the World Health Organization website has a lot of this information. Some of it's a little technical, so much it's a little bit hard to find. But we have started to some of the guidelines, for instance, with birth control pills, class and patients that are obese or have BMIs over 30, we generally put them in a class 2, and they've kept that. But for instance, IUDs, we used to feel that if you had uterine fibroids, that IUDs were relatively contraindicated. So we would say if you had uterine fibroids, then the IUD would be a class 4. But they have upgraded that to saying that fibroids that don't actually distort the lining of the uterus, and this is something that can easily be made on diagnosis with an ultrasound, that they've upgraded that to a class 1 so that individuals who were considering IUD use with fibroids might want to talk to their doctor again and seen. And they've had a few other changes like that, but I thought the fibroid one was the one that might affect my patients quite a bit. Also, in terms of patients with inherited clotting problems, first of all, you have to make the diagnosis, and a lot of people are running around without that diagnosis. That has to be something tested on a blood test. But lastly, we used to say that birth control pills were class 4, but now the progesterone-only methods, including injectable Depo-Provera and the progesterone-only pills, have been upgraded to class 2 recommendation for that, so that there are birth control pills that people with those kinds of disorders, they're called thrombophilias, I think I've talked about them before, could actually use now.
Okay. Anything else real quick that you wanted to mention, or have we pretty much
I think we pretty much okay. mentioned it. I said I would talk a little bit about a few of our studies. There's been a lot of press about HPV prevention. We know that over 40 million Americans do have HPV disease, and we know that HPV-related disease causes abnormal pap smears, precancerous changes of the cervix, genital warts, and cervical cancer. And there's been a lot of work on vaccine development. There was a lot of press about a type of vaccine that was just against HPV 16 and 18 that's being tested. We're testing an HPV vaccine that's against 4 of the different types of the HPV virus, and we're hoping that these studies will show a reduced rate of abnormal pap smears, a reduced rate of precancerous changes of the cervix. It's not something where we'll be able in a few years' time to be able to really demonstrate cancer protection, because cancer takes longer than that to develop, but it does have the potential to dramatically reduce the cervical cancers in both the United States and the world, and 250,000 women worldwide die each year of cervical cancer. 4,000 of those women are Americans, so it's a very important disease to prevent, and we are still enrolling that vaccine trial for people who haven't had precancerous changes of their cervix in the past. We're looking for them to participate in vaccine trials.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being here, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist with practice in our area. She also teaches the U of I Med School and is with us once a month on Monday to talk about women's health. The broadcast today made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal in Champaign. Eastern Rug Gallery offers a collection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes made of pure wool or silk pile, designed to add beauty to any decor, whether homes or offices. Focus 580 also made possible with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. We're going to take a break. When we continue, we'll talk with historian Walter Borneman about his book 1812, The War That Forged a Nation. We'll have news from National Public Radio first, though, an update on the markets.
And with this update on the markets at 10:59, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. Well, wheat, corn, and soybeans rally on fund short covering on